giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody. This is the Giant Robot Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. It is October 8th, and I'm here with Seth Prebatch. How's it going, Seth?
Going well. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So, Seth, you are the chief ninja over at Level Up / Scavenger. Is that true?
That is true.
So, for folks who are way behind the times, can you describe what Level Up is to us?
Sure. So, Level Up is a mobile payment application, a really simple app. You download it to your phone, iPhone, Android, Windows phone. You link your favorite credit card, and then you get to leave your wallet at home and head to any of 4,000 merchants on Level Up, pay with your phone, and there's a bunch of savings and rewards baked in also.
Gotcha. That sounds like a very polished elevator pitch. You may have given that once or twice.
I have actually given it to a venture capitalist in an elevator.
Really?
And led to a next meeting. So yeah, I've had a good shot of practicing.
I'm sure you have. And so I did a bunch of like biographical research on you as I'm preparing for this podcast. And it seems like pitching is something you've actually got a lot of experience with in general.
I've definitely had good shots to practice. One of the weirder sort of bits of history on this is the elementary school I went to, Dexter. Was pre-K all the way through eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And they had you from when you were pre-K, so like five or six, stand up in front of 1,000 people at all school assembly and memorize, I think at that point it was Leo Leone stories, like the little fairy tales, and recite them from memory.
Wow.
So useful stuff if you're looking to terrorize children, but get them ready for VC pitching.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds insanely formative.
It was a very sort of rigorous grammarian school. They were very much into teaching Latin and, you know, math from like age four. It was good education, a little bit of a weird environment, but, you know, ended up well.
A little traumatic, maybe?
A little traumatic, perhaps, yeah.
Huh, interesting. So, how's Level Up going?
So, Level Up is going great. We've been on a pretty sweet tear. The app launched a year and a month ago. Mm-hmm. It was only in Boston. Now we're in 25 cities across the country with offices in seven of them, 4,000 merchants, about 300,000 users. And we're now moving about between $4 and $5 million this month of interchange-free money for merchants, which, you know, where the savings come from for consumers is that the merchants don't have to pay payment processing fees. And so we've now got this still very small but burgeoning economy where suddenly you can move money frictionlessly. Merchants don't have to pay to move it. They give it back to the consumers, and it's still at an early stage, but growing fast.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've seen there are places, I think there's actually somewhere in Harvard Square, and it's like they take cash and Level Up.
So we push people really hard to that. We actually printed up a whole set of stickers, which are cash and Level Up only, and have been, I would say, politely egging merchants on to rip out their credit card terminals. And I don't know, maybe 25 to 50 have done it so far.
Awesome. So if how do you make money if you don't charge money on the interchange?
Sure. So mainly off of tweets. But the other method that we recently announced was that with Level Up, the savings that you're the consumer are getting are also very valuable to the business in that a business will offer you $2 to try them out for the first time. And when the business runs that campaign, if we attract a new customer to the business, we earn 40 cents for every dollar of credit in the campaign.
Mm.
So quick example on that, you know, you're going to Boloco, which is a great burrito place around here. They're offering you $2 because you've never been there before. Level Up drives you there because of that incentive. You spend $10, you really only spend $8 because you save the $2. Boloco is giving you that $2 and paying us, Level Up, 80 cents, 40 cents times the $2, basically for having delivered the customer. And so our long-term view of the economy is that moving money should be free. In much the same way that Google made moving information free, you shouldn't actually have to pay to move dollars back and forth. Instead, you use the data in that to create value for the consumer, value for the business, grow revenue, and monetize off of that lift. And it's sort of a foreign way to look at the economy, but but I think you know, potentially revolutionary.
Yeah, it sort of shifts it from it costs you money to do business to it costs you a bit of money to get customers, which make you more money.
Right. It's advertising. It costs you money to make money, but just running your business should be free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Google made searching free, right? And they decided they could give away a very expensive service. I think it costs Google $10, $20 billion a year to run their search infrastructure, but they give it away for free because they can make more money by adding value around the search.
Mm-hmm.
We think the exact same analogy is true with the economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a really different ballgame to try and make it happen in.
It's interesting to think about tackling things at that scale, like you say, economy, not just like, oh, local payments or something like this. Like it's like you're trying to change the world in a sense here.
So we are, and the good news is it's not just me. If it was just me, it would be I would probably give up and go home right now. But you know, there are now over 100 of us who wake up every morning and think very deeply and work very hard to try and actually make this shift happen. And of course, you take small steps. But like a great guy, Harold Prokop, just joined us, who you know, is now leading our engineering team, and he came from Akamai, where, you know, he also did things that sort of changed the world fundamentally. They now run, I don't know, 30% of internet traffic, a huge amount of downloads every day. And so he's sort of seen one big shift happen of content delivery. And we sort of invited him to join, and he was excited to join to say, hey, like I've done that once, let's do it again. I've never done it before. So it's nice to have people around who sort of have.
Yeah. So Level Up was sort of built or born out of Scavenger, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
So what was the evolution there?
Yeah, so this is a pretty, as all startups are, kind of a strange story. Scavenger was the company that I started when I was back at Princeton, then dropped out, ended up winning the business plan competition. All the cool kids were dropping out of school, decided I had to follow. And what we built for a year and a half was one of the first location-based gaming platforms, sort of in the vein of Foursquare and at that time Gowalla, Brightkite. There were maybe a couple hundred. And it was really successful, grew from zero to now 3 million users, still active. But it had a bunch of things it did really well, driving people to places, and some things that it didn't. Probably the biggest aha moment for us was we ran a campaign with Buffalo Wild Wings, which drove 180,000 people to play at Buffalo Wild Wings locations over 8 weeks. They did 1.2 million challenges, 500,000 rewards. It ended up winning a bunch of awards itself for the campaign. And we brought the data to them and said, hey, look what we made happen. Like, look at all these tweets, look at all these Facebook posts, amazing. And they looked at us and said, that actually made us a ton of money. And they pulled their point of sale data and said, here's what you made us. And we sort of looked at that and were both excited and aghast in that we'd made them a bunch of money and that's great, but we had to rely on them to tell us. So we were clearly missing a huge connection point, which ended up being the transaction. And so we took everything we knew about game mechanics, about mobile, about social, about location, and launched a second product, Level Up, keeping Scavenger going, keeping developing there, but turning a huge amount of focus to, can we use these skills to actually, instead of just moving tweets and Facebook posts, actually move money. And it was a weird path to get there, but has ended up working out really well.
Huh. How do you split your time now between the companies?
So the vast majority of the focus is on Level Up, and it's all the same company. It's just sort of two products. Okay. My day-to-day is you know, almost 100% Level Up at this point. It's Scavenger does incredibly well and adds a lot of value, and the people who use it like it, the universities who use it love it, the brands that use it love it. But in terms of something that really can shift the world in a pretty fundamental way, Level Up has that type of scale. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's what really gets me going in the morning.
Gotcha. So you talk about that's your day is mostly Level Up focused. So you're reading about you, your working day has a bit of...
It's a couple days in each day, hopefully.
Apparently. Yeah. So like what is your schedule? Like what... Walk us through like a week-ish. Like, what are you doing?
Sure. Well, the first thing is I've given up on the idea of a week. Okay. I've shifted to decadays most recently, which is 10 days.
Okay.
Much more efficient, potentially. If you don't do weekends anyways, the Gregorian calendar starts to fall apart no matter what.
Okay.
But I get up at 5 in the morning, almost exactly all the time, mm-hmm. Work for an hour, go running. That's like the one thing I think that keeps me sane. I don't know if other people like have gotten into that, but I cannot work a day without having... at least burned off some level of energy. Get to the office by around 8 or 9, work until, I don't know, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. I usually get 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night, rinse, wash, and repeat.
Huh. And is that enough sleep for you? Is that sufficient?
I've never gotten more, so I hope it's sufficient. So someday as an experiment, I'll do like a 12-hour sleep cycle and see what happens.
Yeah.
How about you? How much do you sleep? You look well-rested.
Oh, thank you. I need like 9 hours. Like 9.5 is about ideal for me. So like your schedule would kill me. I would be like a walking zombie, insanely fast, insanely fast.
Well, there's 5-hour energies and, you know, high paced electro music, sort of all,
yeah,
all matches,
which
together.
Are all like, you know, stopgap measures.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're trying to just push through exhaustion. And so do you love this schedule? Does it feel awesome to you? Like, are you doing exactly what you want to do?
Yeah, it's as fun as it gets. I mean, if it wasn't, it would be really brutal, right? Like the actual amount of work that goes into it is insane. The rest of, you know, I spend a lot of time obviously working with the engineering team. They're all working crazy hours too. Like if we didn't all love what we were doing, it would be really unpleasant and we'd go find something else to do.
Yeah.
The good news is that, you know, even though you sort of have to tackle these massive problems and there are always things that suck, you know, you're on Heroku and Heroku goes down and you have to make sure the failover systems are working. It's like intense amounts of stress. It's all building something that's meaningful and ends up being something that at the end of the day, you can look back and say, hey, that last 24-hour work cycle, like we are now 2 steps closer to a world in which something meaningful has changed, in which money moves freely, in which we can leave our wallets at home. And you know, so when you do get those 3 hours of sleep, you get to rest really well, right? You feel very good about everything.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's fun.
And is that what motivates you is like changing the world? Is that what you're most after?
So it's super cliche, generally speaking, but for the way I like to think about it is not so much as broad as changing the world, because that ends up being something that I think in one way or another everyone wants to do. For us, it's about taking the very specific thing we can change about the world and making sure we do that right. Mm-hmm. And I think at this point, the thing we can shift is the idea that money costs money to move. And that is a fundamentally sort of transformative concept to try and make happen. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you wake up in the morning and you say, I want to change the world, like everyone should do that, but it's a little too broad. If you wake up in the morning and you say, there's this one really specific part of the world that is just broken, but if 100 of us put our heads together and we like really just keep running into walls until we run through them, we can make money flow frictionlessly. And then what sort of comes from that shift will change the world. But it's that shift that we've got to kind of push towards.
Hmm. So do you want to see Visa and Amex just like lying dead on the ground in front of you?
So it's a weird relationship between those guys. And we actually end up working very closely with Visa and MasterCard and Amex, and the founders of Discover Card just invested recently.
Oh.
And so it's this really,
interesting.
Yeah, it's a really fun love-hate relationship, even more awkward than that sometimes is if you look at two of our other investors. There's Google Ventures, which is obviously a separate part of Google from Google Corporate. But Google, of course, has Google Wallet, which is directly competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's T-Ventures, who invested, which is the venture arm of Deutsche Telekom, which owns T-Mobile. And T-Mobile is, of course, doing ISIS, which is also directly competitive. So it's this weird world where I never understood the teenage girl term of frenemy until we started doing payments. But you have more frenemies than you know what to do with. And so, you know, like we have situations where, you know, one wing of a major payments corporation will be at a conference trashing us and being like, Level Up is terrible and these people are a threat and we need to take them down, while they've also got executives in our office figuring out how we can partner.
Yeah.
And that blew my mind for the first couple of months. But if you look at something as intricate as payments and as intricate as the economy, like there are going to be weird elements where what we do is great for some halves of an organization and painful for others. But generally speaking, there are ways we can add value to everyone, because what we're doing is we're pulling the advertising ecosystem into the transactional space. And so we're not just taking money away from Amex, MasterCard, and Visa, even though we are, we're also replacing it with a new revenue stream.
Hmm. Can you talk more about what that is, pulling the advertising into that?
Totally. So going back to this idea of campaigns, right? The $2 you've got at Boloco as a new customer, that to a consumer is a reward, which is great, right? I like it because I've saved $2. But to Boloco, it is essentially an advertisement. Right, it is replacing the money they would have spent in a newspaper ad,
mm-hmm.
or with a Groupon, which is, if you're a business, don't run a Groupon, like it's really bad because you can't track the return. But it's all the same type of ad. It's the ad spending they would have put on Facebook, maybe, or even, you know, another weird way to think of it, that they would have reinvested into bigger signage in their windows. They're always spending money to make more money.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing is we're saying we can make that ad spend much, much more efficient and much, much more real by virtue of the fact that we are running the payment system, so that when you as a consumer spend $2, the business can know if you were the right customer, because they can know when you come back. They can reward you for coming back. They can have loyalty campaigns that all tie into the same system. And so it sort of takes what Google was able to do with Google Analytics and Google AdWords and say, hey, if you're an e-commerce site, I can show you the real value of a consumer from click to purchase to repeat purchase, and brings that into the real world and runs it over the payment rails. And so Visa and MasterCard make, I don't know, $25, $35 billion a year off of interchange, but the advertising ecosystem for the real world is $300, $400 billion. So it's literally an order of magnitude bigger. And if we can take some portion of that and pull that onto the rails, Visa and MasterCard aren't necessarily going to go away. Their business models might shift a lot, but it's all running over, you know, over the payment rails as opposed to over the newspaper's quote-unquote rails or Facebook's quote-unquote rails.
Right. And it takes you from a situation where you put up a billboard and who knows how well it worked versus you ran a campaign to get new customers and you got X customers and they spent this much and on average they spend that much. And
exactly. And even with the billboard companies or the newspaper you know, advertisement ecosystem, we don't want to destroy that at all, right? We've built a way for you to take a Level Up campaign and with a QR code that a consumer can scan with their phone, place that on a billboard or place that on a newspaper advertisement. And then you as a business can suddenly track and say, hey, you know, before I was running newspaper advertisements and I had no idea if they worked. Now I'm running them and I either know they do work or they don't. And if they do, that's great. I'm going to spend more money with them. And if they don't, that's also great because now I know where to spend my money better. So we really, while we kind of, half the time people look at us and say, hey, that company's trying to kill newspaper advertising and kill Visa and kill MasterCard. We're really not. What we're trying to do is make everything more efficient. And in that more efficient world, more money gets pulled in. So even though you now know what works and what doesn't, you're spending so much more money because it now works so much better that it sort of creates a rising tide for everybody.
Hmm. So you mentioned QR codes. Do you worry about people having sort of like QR code phobia or something? I feel like the natural reaction to QR codes for whatever reason is just like distrust.
Yeah. QR codes are for us sort of a delivery mechanism. I'm super not zealous about like QR codes are the future.
Yeah.
I agree. They're kind of funny looking. We're sort of working to embed or edit them so that they look like the Level Up logo. You know, if they've got those three squares in them and Level Up's logo is three squares. Make them look a little bit more approachable.
Mm-hmm.
But the way we look at QR codes is it's not that the QR code itself is important, or even really, this is stranger, that the mobile device itself is important. It's that that is a way of delivering data that lets you do a lot more. So we picked QR code because every consumer device right now has a screen. And I'm pretty confident for quite some time, every consumer mobile device will have a screen. We also support NFC. It's just so few devices have NFC that, you know, if you had NFC, you can pay with Level Up with NFC at the new terminals. But the change in consumer experience is really small.
Hmm. Interesting. So it's sort of an implementation detail then.
Exactly. It falls down to what is the broadest possible way to move a rotating token from device A to device B, and scanning just works well.
Gotcha. So you gave a TED Talk at TEDx Boston.
I did, yeah.
What was that like?
So that was really cool. It was all about, you know, how to use game mechanics to motivate behavior in the real world, and the sort of organization that TED and their subsidiaries TEDx have created is unbelievable, because you really you sort of have these almost like old school Greek philosophy roundtables where everyone gets together and the whole point is just learning.
Mm.
And so I got the chance to speak for, you know, I don't know, 12 minutes on what game mechanics are going to do in the real world to motivate behaviors, whether it's driving them to businesses or helping make education more enjoyable and potentially more effective. And then I think the guy after me was talking about how he had done the world's first complete face replacement surgery, and had literally taken this woman who had been in some terrible accident and her face was basically destroyed, and we transitioned from game mechanics to, you know, 2 second pause and a guy talking about this unbelievable modern day medical miracle where he'd literally taken a face and transplanted it onto this woman and sort of given her back her life. And to have those types of just conversational roundtables going on was unbelievable.
That's awesome. So what do you worry about? What keeps you up at night when you are trying for your 3 hours of sleep? Like what stresses you?
The sirens going around outside.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of things that could possibly go wrong, right? We have huge competitors who are just way bigger and way better funded than we are. To name a few, Google, they've got a couple $1 billion in the bank. Apple, I believe they have the GDP of Greece in the bank, which is, you know, not saying much, but it's still meaningful. There's PayPal.
We're going to get a lot of hate mail from Greek listeners.
Oh, yeah. Please send it to Thoughtbot.
Please don't.
So you know, we've got Apple, obviously. We've got PayPal. We've got the three carriers, AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, getting together to build ISIS. And so one thing that just makes me nervous is we are literally, you know, in a very, very well-built boat that you know, it does things different than everyone else does. We don't charge interchange. We make our money off of advertising. It's a universal experience. But we're going up against, like, the Spanish Armada. And they've got just so much money that, you know, they can do things like, I believe PayPal, they don't talk about this publicly, but I believe they're spending, you know, between $30 and $50 million to buy their way into Home Depot. They want PayPal accepted at Home Depot. So they just went there and they said, hey, if we give you tens of millions of dollars, will you do this? And any sensible merchant would say yes. We've raised $42 million total. Right. So we can't like, it's, that's a lot of money, but compared to what these guys have, it's nothing.
Mm.
So that makes me somewhat nervous. But you know, what I end up feeling better about at the end of the day is that, there are reasons why an entrenched player can't end up winning in the payment space because they have ulterior motivations or they make money in different ways. So if you're Apple, it's very, very hard for you to build a mobile payment solution that's going to be universal, because if I'm Tim Cook, I don't want to build an app that's awesome that works on Android because I want to sell iPhones.
Mm.
And if I'm Google, I'm not sure I want to make my mobile payment system work on Windows Phone. And so it's hard to be universal. If I'm AT&T, I'm not going to make it work on Sprint. If I'm Amex, I'm not sure I want you to be able to link a Visa. If I'm PayPal, I want you to use PayPal. And so all of these other companies that already have existing businesses are trying to protect their existing businesses as opposed to building the best consumer experience.
Mm.
And we don't have an existing business. So we can just start fresh. And while they have huge advantages on the scale front, we have sort of a purity advantage that I think to date has served us very well.
Interesting. So that could kind of be the Achilles heel of those businesses is their existing interests.
It certainly slows them down. And it's what, you know, we're a tiny company, but we are now the second largest mobile payment network in the States, not behind any of the big players, behind Starbucks, who also is doing it. They're not doing it as a network, but for their very pure experience of, I want you to be able to pay at Starbucks. They built a great user experience because they didn't have any conflicting existing interests. They just want to sell coffee at their locations. But they also wouldn't make it work at Seattle's Best Coffee.
Right.
Because they want to sell coffee at Starbucks.
It's like all these things have like fundamental things that are going to limit them. They need to somehow focus down to a smaller,
right,
smaller niche.
We sort of call it trajectorial focus internally, where the way you look at things makes a bunch of sense depending on your history. And in this case, they have a history that makes them look at things in a way that isn't necessarily the best for the consumer.
So when are you happiest?
You know, I can actually probably tell you exactly. I am happiest at 12:32 p.m. every day. No, a.m. The one that's lunchtime. I always get that mixed up.
Okay.
Is that p.m.?
P.m.?
Yes. I am happiest at 12:32 p.m. every day because that is when transactions on Level Up peak. And there's a moment when we have this all streaming in real time through New Relic and, you know, in our own logs. And it's that single minute of time when you can really feel the sort of momentum of the whole thing going. And, you know, I used to be excited because at that moment, I know I would have one transaction in the minute. And now it's, you know, dozens of transactions a second and really, you know, sometimes hundreds or thousands of dollars moving every second. And there's that moment in time every day where actually I try and, you know, make sure to stop at that moment and actually look at the graphs and be like, this is really good, right? This is now actually real. And so much of my life is around building this thing that to have that one moment every day where it's like, yep, real proof that this is working feels very nice.
So you said so much of your life is building this thing. Is there anything outside this? Is there room for you to do other things?
So I do one other type of thing, which is running of some sort. And the team, we have a really weird, active, energetic team. And so for the past couple of weekends, between 10 and 12 other folks from the team, sort of a rotating crew, have gone and we've done some type of adventure race. So 2 weekends ago, we did Reach the Beach, which is a 200-mile relay race from, I think, Mount Cannon to Hampshire Beach. And you just hop into two vans and you run 8 miles and you pass off the baton. And the next guy runs 8 miles, you hop back in the van and drive and pick him up and sort of run your way through the night for about, I think it took us 26 hours. And then this last weekend, six of us went up to Mount Killington and did the Spartan Beast race.
Oh, nice. I'm doing that at Fenway in November.
Oh, it's such a mess. Like be prepared to get absolutely destroyed.
Awesome.
I trained for this thing a little bit and we ended up running up and down Mount Killington four times.
Oh my.
It's 14 and a half miles.
Okay.
They had like 600 meter stretches of barbed wire that you have to like crawl underneath. They have like ropes you have to climb. And the whole thing is just like, it takes a pretty neurotic crew of people to try and go after rebuilding the economy. And like that type of neurosis sort of, you know, plays well when it's like, okay, you're now in the Spartan race. And like, what do you do? Well, there's 600 meters of barbed wire going up a mountain. Have fun.
Do your investors know that you're risking yourself in this manner?
I had to unfriend some of them on Facebook so that it wouldn't freak them out on the weekends. But, you know, I'm sure we've got good insurance.
Yeah.
Something
The thing I'm doing in Fenway, I think, is a smaller scale. I think it's like 3 miles maximum. So
it'll still be brutal. Actually, I may be doing this as well. This is like mid-October.
I think it's like November something.
I'll see you there.
Awesome. Good. I'll be the guy that's tangled in the barbed wire, like crying for mercy, I think. How's your dating life?
Non-existent.
Yeah, no time.
No time. I'm dating the economy, and
gotcha.
It's a very, very fickle thing to date.
You're dating your company.
Yeah. It's okay. I'm quite good at building companies. I think I was quite bad at dating anyways. So this is probably best for everyone.
There's a pretty good anecdote in one of the interviews I read about you with your most recent relationship, where the question was asked to you and your girlfriend.
Yeah, this is my most recent relationship being now like 6 years ago, right?
Okay.
But the way the thing unfolded was I was at, you know, we were sort of on a I think it was like prom night or something. It was sort of group together having dinner, but everyone had dates. Me and my girlfriend got asked how long we'd been dating, and simultaneously I responded 2 weeks and she responded 6 months, and that was instantly the end of the relationship. and since then I haven't quite worked up the courage to try again.
Yeah, that's beautiful. What's been your proudest moment to date?
That's an interesting question. I think probably the most recent one, and the peak one was Nothing insanely special, but 4 weeks ago, we took the whole team out, like literally everybody, to just go sailing, sort of company outing. It was just fun. But afterwards, you know, we had everyone together, and it's, you know, 100 plus people just sort of sitting outside, you know, hanging out, chatting, and we all got together for sort of a group picture, and it was a really powerful moment of 100 plus people, all like-minded, all incredibly bright, incredibly talented, with like the most diverse series of backgrounds, the most, you know, random types of people you could possibly imagine, but all incredibly happy, taking, you know, a wonderful like 3-hour break from an otherwise absurd life trying to build, you know, this product that we're all working on. And it was a nice sort of physical embodiment of what, you know, of what we're trying to build, of everyone being together, being happy. And that picture, you know, I've got a copy on my wall, and it's like an actual physical printed copy of it on my wall. And that was really great. So that, you know, sort of representation of the team and what we're doing, I think is the height for me at the moment.
Mm. So how old are you?
I'm now 23.
23. And so do you ever step back and be like, I'm 23, I'm running a 100-person company, we're processing thousands of dollars in orders per minute, and just like kind of have your mind blown a little bit?
No, I'm impatient. That's nowhere near enough. It's
okay.
I'm 23. I think there's a fun saying that it's like, you know, by the time Mozart was 33, he was already dead for 5 years, right? So like there's all sorts of things that you should be doing. And you know, I think especially in the modern age and sort of the post Facebook world, your physical age has almost nothing to do with anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know people who are 65 and who are the most active, young-hearted, energetic people ever. Some of them work at Scavenger and Level Up. I also know people who are, you know, my age and still trying to figure it out. And either works. You know, it's really just about what you're looking to do at that moment in time. But for me, I try and judge my life not by anything sort of as rudimentary, as basic years I happen to have been on this planet, mm-hmm. but by where I think I am in terms of what I'd like to build. And by that measure, I'm still a toddler, and I've got a ton left to do. And so I neither really have time to think about it, nor does it sort of, you know, jump into my everyday life.
Hmm. Do you picture yourself reaching a moment of contentment and satisfaction and being like, yes, this is enough? Or is the enjoyment the continual building?
So that's actually a great question. And there's a key word in there, which is contentment, which I believe being content to be the single most dangerous state that you could ever possibly fall into.
Hmm.
And when people ask me, you know, the thing that I'm most afraid of, it is feeling content, because there is so much broken about the world. There is so much that can be better in all sorts of different vectors. And whether it's small things like, you know, like Instagram, people always joke about how sort of Instagram isn't that big a deal. And it's like, no, like there was something broken, which as trivial as you might think it is, was people sharing photos in a way that was enjoyable to them. And that was actually huge, mm-hmm. right? And with so many things ranging from that to, you know, to the economy, to healthcare, to education, I don't think any of us have the luxury of being content. And so we shouldn't be. You know, until we've found life somewhere else in the universe, until we've solved cancer, until we've solved poverty and have everything like actually just working, which by definition of stating that is never going to happen. There's always going to be things we can do better. Just as people, we shouldn't ever let ourselves be content. And so that's the one thing I'm afraid of. And to date, I found enough interesting things to try and work on that I hope I never get there.
You probably got a lifetime worth of it.
Yeah, at least maybe a couple. You know, so pull an Iron Man.
Yeah. So you're just going to keep on raging until it's all over.
Yeah, that would be the life for me. I certainly, it's been good so far.
Huh. I think over like an 80 or 90 year lifespan, I will sleep like an additional like 10 years over you. So you have no excuse if you don't get everything done, I think, by
exactly.
the time you're dead.
I'll send you some 5-hour energies in the mail.
Okay. No,
that'll help.
Maybe we can meet somewhere in the middle. You can sleep like 3.5 hours and I'll
exactly.
knock it down to like 8.5 and we'll call it a fair compromise. I've noticed I've done some work at Level Up as a...
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it was great.
Great work, I should say.
Oh, thank you. And I'll say that you're very good at describing things in a way that gets people excited. Like, it's very good, like, CEO quality. I remember it was my very first day, and you're like, we're going to sit down and talk about this amazing new thing I have. I know how campaigns are going to work, and we're going to destroy the advertising and credit card industries at the same time.
Totally.
And I'm going to describe it to you in 10 minutes. And, like, I was surprised at how excited I got by that. Are you ever doing this despite your own doubts about the idea, or are you really like, is it always 100% that, or is there some aspect of that which like you're like, I'm the leader, I have to inspire the troops basically, so I'm going to show this game face and just charge forward?
So I think in the earlier days of building Scavenger as sort of a company, there were definitely times when I felt like that, where I, you know, I am often very excited about things, and then other times there are things which I'm more nervous about, and you sort of have to put a game face on. And I think for the first, the company's now, I guess, 2.5, 3 years old. Level Up itself is only a year and a month old. I sort of would make an effort to hide any doubts. I stopped doing that about a year and a half ago for two reasons. One, I think the transparency of, hey, there are some things that I just don't get. And like, that's okay. You know, like sometimes people ask me, okay, you know, what will happen when Apple introduces a payment system? Because I believe they will. And I've got some good theories on why I think it won't work. It might not be universal, but the best response I can give is, you know, they will do that. It will be scary. We are an incredibly bright team of people. Here's how I think we'll handle it now. But I'm confident in us figuring it out more so than, hey, it's just going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. The second reason I stopped doing it is I stopped giving myself the luxury of being okay with not feeling confident in what we were doing. So if I didn't think something was working, the right solution isn't to put on a game face and say, hey, this is going to be great. It's to actually openly state, hey, that is broken. Mm. And as a team, we need to figure out why we feel weird saying that out loud and see if we can't do it better. Mm-hmm. And a large part of that has motivated the shift from Scavenger as a social platform with check-ins as the core action to Level Up as a transactional platform. Because one of the things we always felt a little wonky saying was, to local businesses at least, Scavenger as a check-in game is going to drive you a lot of revenue. We couldn't feel confident stating that. For universities, for big brands like Coke, it makes a huge amount of sense. But for a local business, we needed to be able to say, you're going to put in this effort and you're going to get out dollars, and we couldn't. And so rather than, you know, being the sort of eloquent CEO and trying to talk my way out of that trap, the reality was, no, that is broken. So we're smart. Let's go back to the drawing board. Let's figure it out. And let's find something where the excitement that I get to, you know, portray, and I am really excited almost all the time, doesn't have to be an act. It's actually, yeah, this is really good. And if we ever hit something where it isn't, I won't let myself act it out. I'll be like, you know what? We've got a problem. Let's get back to the point where we can care about it.
Mm. And I've noticed, it seems a little paradoxical, but oftentimes admitting uncertainty inspires more confidence in people.
Definitely.
Like okay, he's willing to say when he doesn't know what's going to happen or that he's afraid about this thing or that thing. Therefore, when he says he is confident and, you know, things are good, I can trust it.
Yeah, no one wants to be misled either intentionally or unintentionally by anyone. I certainly would hate to have it be done to me. And you know, one of the sort of forcing functions on this that is nice is we tend to hire absurdly bright people. So, you know, even if I tried very hard, I'm not sure I'm going to pull the wool over anyone's eyes, mm-hmm. right? And I don't want to. And it does mean that, you know, when we do get to talk about campaigns and Interchange Zero and all these things that are exciting, not only do I like showing my excitement about it, but I can sort of do an internal gut check and be like, hey, am I really as excited as I sound? And the answer is like, actually, maybe I'm a little more excited, right? Maybe I need to tone it down because otherwise I'll just be, you know, jabbering about sort of nonsense. But it's nice to have those, the sort of what you get to portray and what is actually real line up.
Mm, definitely. I want to ask you a personal question.
Sure.
So I found a quote from your dad, actually, which says, with both kids, describing you and your sister, with both kids, my wife and I pushed them very hard, very invasive, very intrusive, doing things, planning things continuously. Was that tough to live with?
It was both tough to live with and great. So my parents are incredibly aggressive people. My dad passed away recently, but he was a biotech entrepreneur and had basically spent his entire life tackling problems which even strike me as absurdly difficult. Because like at least with software, you know, you have bugs, but you can also debug them, right? When you're doing biotech, like you have bugs and, you know, no two human bodies are exactly the same. And so you can't run some script and like get the output. You sort of are just often running very, very blind. So he was tackling these problems, which were insanely hard. And my mom is a VP of investment banking at what is now, I believe, it's Smith Barney. And I think it's owned by some other bank. They switch owners like every couple of weeks because that's mm-hmm. how Wall Street works. But, you know, they both sort of took their level of business prowess and just aggression as humans and really trained it into myself and my sister. We never did normal vacations. We never went to the beach. We never had a television. We would go all across the world and do great things. But we'd go there and the game was, you know, hey, we're going to go to China. And Daniela and Seth, like, plan a trip and document everything, right? Like the hotel room we were in, every single museum, every piece of art, like just, you know, every piece of history, weird stuff that trained into us a level of, you know, I think activity that ended up being a pretty useful life skill. And I owe them a lot for that.
Would you raise your children in the same way?
Me raising children, I think, should be a felony, probably. But, you know, if that ever happens, yeah. I mean, you know, parents are there to push their kids. And certainly, like, did I rebel against it? Sure. I'm sure I must have been a terrible kid. But that type of pressure, it's like having a good coach. You know, you don't want your coach to be your best friend. You want your coach to be the person who makes you the best runner. And I think parents are, you know, if there's anything like a life coach, you know, that's what they're doing. And so it isn't, you know, it isn't that they were always doing the thing that made you the happiest at that moment. But, you know, 5 years, 10 years later, looking back and being like, yeah, you know, we didn't go to the beach, but they did tell me to build a lemonade stand and sit out front and, like, you know, earn the money I wanted to spend on whatever toy I was going to get. Yeah, that's cool.
Interesting. So just hanging out with you at the level of office and seeing things, like, I think you have more notifications go off per minute than anybody I've ever seen. It's like 3-4 emails, a Skype request, you know, a text. Like, it's just a bombardment. Do you worry about your focus when you're getting, like, these constant interruptions?
So I did recently run out of Gmail chat windows. I don't know if you've ever had Gmail say to you, you have too many chat windows and you have to, like, refresh your page. Uh-huh. That was sort of a moment of existential dread for me.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, yeah, there are definitely times when that's a little bit overwhelming. But the reason why I don't worry about it too much from a focus perspective is that, you know, I divide days into segments, right? So during the traditional workday, or, you know, like 8 to 7 or 7 or 8 at night, my job is to be working with other people. And so the fact that I'm getting tons of inbound requests and tons of chats and tons of pings and the phone's ringing and text messages, whatever, like, that's what I'm meant to be doing. And so it's my job to, you know, up my ability to handle all of those and make sure that everyone else is still moving, automate what I can, get myself out of the chains I don't want to be on.
Mm-hmm.
And then from, you know, from 8 p.m. onwards and you know, the traditional weekends, I
kind of describe a traditional workday as 8 to 8.
Yeah, exactly. It's a weird world.
Uh-huh.
You know, those are times when I can sit in a room and sit in front of a whiteboard and actually just think much more deeply about, you know, where we're headed.
Mm.
And so there's a big difference between, you know, strategic moments of time, let's sit down and think, and operational moments of time, let's just do.
Hmm.
And for that, I'm glad GChat exists, right? Because it's without these types of tools, you know, I just wouldn't be able to do the things that I want to. I wouldn't be able to go to meetings offsite because I'd be disconnected from everything. But thanks to the glory of Apple and Android, you know, you can be kind of anywhere.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate you turning your phone off for the length of this podcast.
Yeah, no, it's good.
I appreciate your focus. That's excellent. So you get interviewed a lot, it seems like. What question do you wish people asked you that they don't?
That exact question. No, that is a great question. I'm actually somewhat stumped. Let me think on that for a moment. So I actually think probably the most interesting question that could be asked would be, if I were one of my competitors, how would I stop what I'm doing now?
Awesome. I love it.
And take it over.
You have to answer that now.
Sure. And I'm not sure exactly how I'd do it, but I think that's the interesting thesis. So say I was Amex, right? They have such an insane advantage over what we're doing. They have all the cardholders. They already have all the information, or Apple or you know, MasterCard. They all kind of are in the same space or have the same advantage. If I were them, I would take the advertising model that we've built and not get rid of my interchange model initially, but layer it on top of that, start building a revenue stream off of that, build my own mobile app, be agnostic, right? If I'm Amex, let MasterCard and Visa link, because you want to control the ecosystem, not your own cardholders. And while it would be too difficult for me to give up on interchange immediately, because I make $10 billion a year off of it, I could build up that advertising revenue stream to the point where it's close enough, and then just do a complete flip, do sort of a Lou Gerstner IBM type transition, where you just say, yeah, that's the future. And yes, you're going to lose 5,000 jobs in the interim, but you're going to build another 25,000 on sort of this new skill set. And I think that in reality, the most interesting thing no one's ever asked me is that could really happen. And it doesn't strike me as that far from the imagination that if they really stepped back and really had the vision to look at it, they could do that. I don't think they will. I hope they won't.
Yeah.
But that would be what I would ask me.
Awesome. I'm actually going to write that question down as, like, I think any founders I talk to from now on, I need to have them answer that.
Yeah.
How would you coach your competitors into killing you?
Yeah. And it's worth thinking through.
Right.
One of the games we play at Level Up all the time is war games, where, you know, we have the war room, we've got that big circular table, and we'll take, you know, and I do this all the time with people, we'll take different sectors of the company and sit them down and say, okay, here is the war game. Amex has just launched this feature, and, you know, and for whatever reason, we have this scaling issue that we have to deal with, so our engineering resources are blocked. And, oh, by the way, Google's just said they're going to do that, React. And it's literally, it's like a role-playing game, right? Except, you know, you're not moving like, you know, your wizard to a different point in whatever game you're playing. You're actually trying to deal with some real-world scenario that the person who's administering the war game gets to set up.
Interesting.
And it's a fun way to think about it, because people think so much about crushing their competitors, and there's often more insight to be gained from, if I were my competitor, how would I crush me?
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to react to that.
Address that weakness.
There are smart people out there, right? I'm not the only person thinking about payments. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone's going to get those thoughts, and we've got to be sort of ready.
Mm. Awesome. One last question for you.
Sure.
What do you want your legacy to be?
That's another really good question. I do have a strange fascination with Ozymandias as sort of like the Greek hero who managed to pull that off. Also the Great Watchman character, but the Greek one's a little more effective. At this moment, I think if I could even be so optimistic as to think I will get a legacy, what I would want it to be is the team, more so than just me, that made money move frictionlessly. And that as a single statement is what I would like us to do, in the same way, you know, Facebook as Zuckerberg, but really a team made social sharing frictionless, and Google, and I think they've done a very good job at Google of really putting the team first, made information flow frictionlessly. They categorized the world's information. I would like the Level Up team to be the one that goes down in history as these guys found a way to make money flow frictionlessly, and the effect that had on the economy was really good. Doesn't have to be anything more sophisticated than that, just it was good.
Got it. All right, we'll write that down.
Yeah, totally.
So if someone wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Sure. I'm on Twitter, the Twitters, at Seth Priebatsch. If they want to email me, my emails are super easy. I'm just seth@scavenger@thelevelup.com.
Okay. Can you spell Priebatsch real quick? Just...
Oh, yes. Can I spell that? I should write down. It's Priebatsch.
Excellent.
And if you're ever in Boston, I'm the kid in orange.
Awesome. And how do we try out Level Up?
So download the app for free to iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and just give it a try.
Yeah, and I'm not being paid to say this, but I am a user and appreciator, and I enjoy it, so give it a shot. I can fully recommend it. So I think that actually wraps things up. Thanks very much for joining me, Seth. I appreciate it.
Totally. Thanks for having me.
You've been a great guest. Now, a couple events I want to mention before we go. I'm going to be giving a talk, actually two talks, the same talk, at two different places. It's called Refactoring Good to Great. I'll be giving it first at Aloha Ruby, October 8th through 10th. In Hawaii, so if you want to come get some sun, join me there. Mike Burns will be giving a talk called Scala on Android at the Stockholm Google Technology User Group on October 9th. Also, he's giving a talk called The Expression Problem, October 30th at Riga Ruby Group in Latvia. And finally, I'm giving that talk once more at RubyConf at November 1st through 3rd in Denver. So hopefully I'll see some of you folks there. By the way, this is episode 15 of the podcast. You can get all the notes and links to things we talked about in the episode at thoughtbot.com/podcast/15. Today's podcast was recorded by Shauna Quinthal, edited by Edward Lovell, and produced by Chad Pytel. Thanks for listening.